Well, please turn with me as we look in Psalm chapter 26 tonight. An encouraging psalm to me in many respects, and I trust it will be to you. We're going to be looking at the specifics of this psalm and the setting in which it's placed. And after we get finished with the specifics, we're going to kind of do a flip. We're going to talk about the general focus of the psalm. So usually we go from general to specific. Tonight we're going to go from the specific to the general. In this particular psalm, the time that it's written, we believe it's probably around 2 Samuel chapter 6. Now that's probably not telling you a whole lot, but what is happening at this particular juncture is that David has now assumed the position of king, not only in the realm of Judah, but now in the realm of Israel. So the two are coming together through David. His desire is to take the Ark of the Covenant and bring it into his newfound city, which he just conquered from the Jebusites, the city of Jerusalem. At this time, the Jebusites had been in control of it, but it is now being called the City of David. This time he begins to celebrate because the Ark of the Covenant is coming home. And most of us are familiar with the picture or the story in which David begins jumping around and celebrating. And at this juncture, his wife, looks down upon him for doing so. But this particular psalm makes reference to his joy over the Ark of the Covenant coming home. It needs to be understood that his joy is coming out of something. And that's really kind of the point of this particular psalm, that the first five chapters of 2 Samuel are, David's assuming his rightful position, and we know that for pretty close to, 7.5 years, he was king just over Judah, and then for 33 and some odd years later, he's now king over Jerusalem, or Judah and Israel. So he combines the two. But it's these initial times, it's the initial beginnings of this kingdom that has some difficult things happen. And one of the things that are difficult is that David's having to handle some of his, we're going to call them nephews, really are fit to be tied kind of soldiers. I mean, they really love to kill people. And David does all that he can to pull them back, but they just always want to kill somebody. And so you have Abishai and Asahel and Joab. And these three brothers are, the sons of Zariah, the bane of a lot of his problems. David has already made some stands initially as king. There was the one Amalekite that came and said that he slayed Saul, and he goes, "How dare you slay God's anointed?" And so David has him, slain right there. And so he begins to deal with this, and the northern tribe looks at this and they go, "Wow, so you must be really for us," and it begins to pull the kingdom together. In the midst of David trying to pull the kingdom together, he's got these three brothers that are just a real problem. Abner, who was basically second-hand man to Saul at the time that he was reigning, basically rules the northern tribe, and he's kind of the king of that northern tribe. He's taking control of it, even though Ishbosheth in name is reigning. Abner really is reigning as a general. And there's one interesting scene in which, and I'm not going to get into all the things that are in the text, but there's one particular scene in which there are 12 of Abner's men, and there are 12 of Joab and David's men, and they're sitting around a pool, and they look at each other and they go, "Hey, how about a contest?" So they both go, yeah, let's do a contest. So the 12 of them begin to stab each other, cut each other up, and this is the contest, and pretty much wipe out Abner's men, Joab's men, do. It seems to infer that maybe there was loss of life on that side too. But anyway, Joab wins, and you know, I don't know. Maybe they just didn't have anything to do, but they felt better about things. And then because of that particular incident, one of the brothers starts running after Abner, and he's really fast, so he's catching up to him. And Abner's saying, I don't want to kill you, son. And the boy's going, I'm coming after you. And he goes, look, don't make me do something, because I can't outrun you. And the guy just keeps coming. So Abner stops. He takes his spear, and he doesn't use the sharp end. He just uses the brunt end, and it actually goes clear through him and kills him. Well, guess what the other two brothers want to do? they want to get even. So in the meantime, Abner has been talking with David, and he says, look, I want to hand over the northern kingdom to you. You know, I think you're the guy. And God has ordained. And so we're seeing a good rapport here, and everything's going well. And so David invites him over, and Abner goes, yeah, I'm going to back you. I'm going to be part of your team. And David goes, great, because I love you guys. And then, so he leaves. Actually, the text says that he leaves in peace. And so Joab walks in. He goes, did I hear that Abner's been here? And David goes, yeah. He goes, and you let him go? He goes, yeah. So Joab doesn't tell David, but he goes after Abner. And he walks up to Abner, you know, I'm paraphrasing, walks up to Abner and says, hey, how's it going? And then he kills him. So not a long dissertation there, but he just kills him. And David finds out, and he goes, what are you doing? And one of the interesting statements there in 2 Samuel is that, you know, you guys, I don't think I can take you anymore, you know. And so you can hear him just coming to his wit's end. And then there are two other brothers that come from, they were generals in Saul's army that were under Ishbosheth. And they come in, and they murder Ishbosheth in the middle of the night in his bed and cut off his head. And they bring his head to David. And David goes, what are you doing? And they go, we thought you'd want him dead. He goes, I killed the guy that killed Saul. What do you think I'm going to do to you? So David has their arms and their legs cut off and kills them. And this is what precedes this psalm. Now the question you have to ask yourself is why is David writing what he's writing? And the reason he's writing it is he wants to get out of this subterfuge and all this clandestine hatred. I mean, how do you do that? I mean, these are his own men. He's got basically two choices. He lets them go around and keep on killing other people that they probably shouldn't kill, or he kills them. And you can't kill your sister's kids. It's just kind of an unwritten law. You just don't do that. So he's kind of stuck with them. See? But he knows their heart, and he just hates the fact that, in fact, I just read you that last verse, if you look with me in 2 Samuel. See, you thought you had it hard. You don't have a hard. You don't have a hard life. David, in chapter 3 of 2 Samuel, chapter 3, David said to Joab and all the people who were with him, look, you killed this great man. Tear your clothes off and gird yourself with sackcloth and ashes and lament over him, because this is a great man. And David chants a lament over Abner in verse 33 and 34. And then all the people say, you know, Dave, you need to eat something. He goes, I'm not going to eat anything until the sun goes down. And they go, wow, you really did love Abner like we did. And so the people of Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king to put Abner to death, but basically Joab did it on his own. Then it says, that's verse 37. Then verse 38, then the king said to his servants, do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? And I am weak today, though I'm anointed king, that these men, the sons of Zeruiah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil. Now, what he had said earlier about Joab is in verse 29, may evil fall on the head of Joab and on all of his father's house, and may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, or one who is a leopard, or one who takes hold of a distaff, or one who falls by a sword, or one who lacks bread. In other words, he's saying, I hope he gets his, but he's still not going to do anything to him. He's having to deal with these people that are going around murdering people. He's trying to pull the nation together, and he's got this going on all over the place. I mean, how do you control that? These guys are warriors. That's what they do. They kill people. That's what warriors do. So, you know, on peaceful days, they don't know what to do with themselves. He writes this psalm. As you come to through all that, and now you come to chapter 6, he's bringing the Ark of the Covenant back, and his desire is to fellowship with people that want to do the right thing. And so it's this psalm that really conveys his heart. If you look with me in chapter 26 in verse 1, it starts off with him crying unto God to vindicate him. In many respects, what he's actually saying, and it could be translated this, in fact, I think it is translated in Jeremiah 5:28, defend me. Because he knows that there's all kinds of sources and all kinds of people that are doing things underhanded, behind his back, around his back, whatever. And he's not able to control this. So, God, I come to you. You got to take care of this thing. It's too much for me. I mean, he already says within the Samuel, "This is, I'm too weak for this. I can't handle it." And this is still David at his early stages. So we know this is not old age talking. This is just David overwhelmed by this kind of way of living. So he starts off by saying, "Vindicate me, O Lord, for I have walked in my integrity." Now, if you would, underline that word integrity, because that's going to be the key to this particular psalm, the word integrity. It's a very simple word as far as just the pronunciation of the Hebrew. It is just literally the word tom. It would be spelled like Tom, but you would pronounce it tom. Integrity is, and this word that he uses for this, it sometimes is translated as uprightness, which is interesting. It has the specific emphasis of simplicity of heart. So when he talks about, you know, I'm walking in integrity, what he's basically saying is I'm not like those guys that have some kind of evil plan, and I'm trying to sort of push it underneath the rug. I'm not that guy. I mean, face value, I'm going to do what, I mean, you know me. I'm transparent. And in a way, the integrity is a kind of transparency. It's an honesty. It's a forthrightness. It's an uprightness. It's the kind of person that you know they are basically who they say they are. And they'll do what they say they're going to do. What he's asking God to do is to look at the integrity of his heart. You know who I am. And the request as it goes on is asking God to really examine. He says, look, you know, a person that's honest and transparent has no problem being examined by God. In fact, he calls upon God to do that. But what's interesting to me about the psalm itself is you're going to see how valuable this is, because in many respects, I don't think we give integrity the place that it really deserves in our life, or that sense of honest transparency before God and how important it is. I mean, how wonderfully important it is. Because we know that, as Samuel says earlier in 1 Samuel, as he was even choosing whether or not he was going to make David the king or not, he was going to anoint David, but he didn't know that. But the declaration of God to Samuel was, man looks at the outward appearance, but God looks at the heart. So I know that you're going to go through a lot of boys here, but when all is said and done, we're going to pick the youngest little guy out in the field with the sheep, and that's the guy we're going to choose, because I see the guy's heart. So David has walked in the integrity of his heart. In fact, it is literally going to be the standard by which God sets for every king after David. That's an interesting point. Let me give you an example of this. I found in 1 Kings chapter 9, if you look there with me. 1 Kings chapter 9, in which Solomon is made king and is dedicating the house of the Lord. And in chapter 9, in verse 1, it reads, "Now it came about when Solomon had finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house and all that Solomon desired to do, that the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time." This is very interesting to me, because I can't think of a text where the Lord appeared to David. Anyway, "The Lord appeared to Solomon a second time as he had appeared to him at Gibeon. And the Lord said to him," you might want to underline this, "The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and your supplication, which you have made before me, and I've consecrated this house, which you have built, by putting my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you will walk before me as your father David walked," what does it say?
Integrity.
"In the integrity of heart and uprightness, doing according to all that I commanded you, and will keep my statute and ordinance, then I'll establish this throne forever." That's the standard. The standard is the integrity of his heart. This is the standard by which he sets. "And if you'll maintain this standard, I'll establish your kingdom forever." So Psalm 26 is going to be about this integrity. It really is about, and Job makes an interesting statement. Actually, it's Eliphaz in Job chapter 4, verse 6. As I think he rightly proclaims, even though he probably wasn't the best of counselors, his theology was correct. And his declaration is not your fear of the Lord your confidence, and the integrity of your ways your hope? Now, if you heard what that, if you heard what that was saying, it's telling you that integrity is what is going to give you confident expectation into the future if you walk in integrity. If you're not walking in integrity, you're not going to see the future as a wonderful thing. Because it's the integrity that will establish your protection, the integrity of your heart. David knew that this would guard his heart and would keep him from dangers. In fact, interestingly enough, in Psalm 41:12, he says that it's the integrity that would cause God to hold him up. And Proverbs talks about it in chapter 2, verse 7, and describes literally that integrity as a shield. So what is clear is that integrity is a protection, it's a shield, but more than that, according to Proverbs 10:9, it's that which gives you something sure and steadfast. So it's stability. Bottom line, integrity is very important. So he calls unto God and he says, "You're going to have to defend me, because I've got a lot of problems here." And on those days that you have things that are happening that clearly are out of your control, things that are going on in your life, and It might be a tax, it might be other things that are happening, but they're clearly overwhelming. Guess what's going to guard you? The integrity of your heart. Now, once again, when he's making reference to this, what he's talking about is I've been transparent with you, God. I mean, look, we know God sees through us anyway. But what God is wanting us to do is be honest with him about who we are. Once again, you go back to the simplicity of 1 John chapter 1, don't tell me you're not sinning, that you're lying. So let's just start off by, if you'll be honest with me, we can have an honest relationship. If you can't be honest with me, then we can't have fellowship. So the transparency of David, in which he conveys to God, literally, look, God, and I'm putting in the setting of 2 Samuel. Look, God, you know what I want. I just want to be with God's people that want to do the right thing, and I want to be with you. And that's it. I mean, there's nothing convoluted here. You know this. Why am I surrounded by these people? You know? So he says, look, this is the integrity. I have trusted, I put my confidence in the Lord. What's the phrase? Without wavering. You know this to be true. You know that you're the one I'm hoping on, not anything else. And you're the one I think about, and you're the one I want to do things for, and you're the reason that I'm king of this nation, and you know me. Verse 2, examine me. Check me out. Go. Scrutinize. Probably the best way to describe that word would be basically, you know, putting it in a fire, because what he's actually going to be using are, I would say, words that describe a refiner's fire for metal. But examine me, O Lord. Try me would be refiner's fire within the text. Test my mind. Now, that's a very interesting word. I think the King James puts in there, test my reins. It actually literally is test my kidneys. The emphasis even isn't as much on kidneys, and I like the fact that King James puts reins in there, which is kind of in some way tied to even veins, which is very interesting. But reins, like, yeah. Well, reins, and it could be on a horse, but reins can stand for two things that are going side by side together, like ropes. That actually make reference to that without it being to a horse. It could be like veins in your body. The reason why he uses this is because, if you're accused of lying before the government, sometimes they'll hook you to a lie detector. And what the lie detector does is it attaches not to your voice as much as it does to your body functions. And if you're lying, it's monitoring your perhaps heartbeat going a little off, or maybe veins restricting or whatever. But something's going on in your body that's saying, you ain't telling the truth. And what he's saying here is, and you know, I think the tendency is to think, well, that was way back then. They don't know anything about body. Oh, they knew very much about body functions. So he says, I know that, you know, verbally I could lie. Take my pulse. Find out, whatever. Put me on a lie detector. See if it's just like straight line. Because I'm telling you, this is how I feel. I want to trust in you. I want to hope in you. I don't want to be with these people anymore. So examine me, O Lord. Try me. Test my mind, or more specifically, my kidneys and my heart. Test my emotions, how I feel about things. Because your emotions really will reveal how you feel about something. And forget about what you say. Psychologists oftentimes talk about body language, you know. So when they're counseling you, maybe 30%, they're listening to what you're saying. About another 70%, they're watching your body language. So, test me. For thy loving kindness is what I'm looking at. That's what I'm focused on. And I have walked in sincerity and genuineness and transparency. He uses the word truth here within the text, doesn't he? I've been true blue here. Now, the reason why this is so important for him right now, once again, is those three brothers, those other two brothers, the same thing with Abner. I mean, the whole thing is just full of politics and trickery and deceit and all kinds of terrible things. And nobody's really being upfront or honest. And once again, he wants the people to pull together. He wants everybody to get together. I think one of the frustrating things oftentimes that I have found within church is, you know, let's just serve the Lord. Forget about all of the politics and what somebody's doing over here, and, you know, people want to gossip about this and they want to stab somebody. Stop. Let's just serve the Lord. Can we just serve the Lord? So that's what he's saying within the passage. And he says, this is how I walk. This is where I go. Verse 4. It almost sounds like we're quoting Psalm chapter 1, in which he starts off, I do not sit with deceitful men. I'm not going to hang around them. They're not a part of my life. And once again, the whole deceitful thing, it's a very interesting word in and of itself, because it's making reference to idols. And, that this particular word is used to describe idols. His point is that somebody's putting their trust or saying that they will do something, but they don't follow through in it. In other words, people make promises that they don't keep. Or in Joab's case, he'll act like he's your friend and then he'll stick a sword through you. So, you know, there's a lot of lying going on. So his and this is the reason why they actually use this word to describe an idol. Because an idol is that which says it's going to do something, but it doesn't do anything. You know, it's just a lump in a giant paperweight. So the phrase is, I do not sit with deceitful men, nor will I go with what?
Pretenders.
See? This is what he's battling with. He's dealing with Alam, the hypocrites. It would be another word that you could put within here. It's almost a pharisaical text in this regard. Imposters, dissemblers would be another word that is used. I think the King James may use that particular word to describe this particular passage. And what it's talking about, of course, are people that are literally trying to mislead people. It's just always been hard for me to fathom that people would willingly try to mislead somebody. I don't understand, why would somebody do that? And in many respects, I think that David is saying, you know, am I crazy? Am I the only one that thinks this way? Am I the only one that just wants us to do the right thing? That I'm really genuine in this? So I'm not going to go with deceitful men, and I'm not going to go with pretenders. Psalm 81, is just to kind of have you, I mean, we're in Psalm, so it shouldn't be hard to find. But Psalm chapter 81, you can see the hatred of God towards those that pretend. And, nothing could be more ludicrous than trying to fake God out, obviously. But in Psalm 81, God is crying out, oh, that my people, verse 13, would listen to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. I would quickly subdue their enemies and turn my hand against their adversaries. That's an interesting phrase. I would quickly do this. But what's holding him back is that there are those that would pretend obedience to him. And what he means by this is their heart's not in it. I mean, you can say to God, you know, I'm all in, and, you know, pray, but you're not in it like David was, probably. I mean, David is like wrapped up. I mean, I only want to follow God, and he's intense on this. God is saying, if you'll abide by the same standard of David's heart, I'll protect you. Now, at this juncture, of course, David hadn't done a lot of things that ultimately ended up being wrong in his life. He had a fairly clean slate. But the point is, if he had maintained integrity, God was guaranteeing protection. But verse 15 reads, those who hate the Lord pretend obedience to him. And God knows who they are, and they're, well. This is an interesting point, too, that I just want to make. There are things that happen to people that maybe from the outside we see, that's horrible, that's terrible, that should have never happened to those people. Yeah, but there's one thing that we don't see. The heart. We just don't see that. God does. And everything that God does is right, is just, is accordance with what is best for that person as he sees that heart. So once again, I just want to emphasize, God is judging the integrity of the heart. He says, I'm not going to go with these men. And he says in verse 5, I hate the assembly of evildoers. These are the people that, you know, virtually plan to do wrong and plan to hurt people or plan to take advantage of people. And I shall not sit with the wicked. These would be the people that disregard God as well as do something immoral. I shall wash my hands, watch the phrase here, in what? Now, that's an interesting phrase because, I mean, probably most of us wash our hands in water. But he's washing his hands in what?
Innocence.
What cleanses you? Yeah. What he's talking about here, of course, is that which is clear. Innocence actually means clear, clean, pure. What he's talking about is not the fact that David has never sinned. That's not what he's talking about. What he's talking about is that his motives are crystal clear. We've all done things wrong, as Scripture says. We've all sinned in many ways. But when you start getting serious with God, you come to God and you go, look, I'm serious. I'm getting right. And check me out. Check out my heart. Because I'm washing everything today in pure motives. That's what I'm washing everything in. You can see my heart, you can see my life, and I'm getting clean here. I shall wash my hands in innocence, and I will go about thine altar, O Lord. I will encircle myself around your altar. It's a very strange statement, but the description is one in which he continues to encircle around the altar, if I can put it this way, until he becomes like the altar. It's an interesting description because what he's virtually saying is I want to hang around you till I become like you. As we've oftentimes quoted Ephesians chapter 5, be imitators of Christ. And don't be deceived, bad company corrupts good morals. The people that you hang around, that which you hang around, you become like. And he says, you know what I want to become like? You. Now the altar is that picture of selfless sacrifice. And it's this Ark of the Covenant that has on top of it the mercy seat, which the Jews knew that this is the place where the Messiah would someday sit. They didn't know how it was going to work out, that he would reign in mercy, but somehow that was going to happen. He says, cause this to rub off on me. Because, man, I don't like what I'm seeing out there. I don't like what's happening in the world around me. And I don't like what they're doing. And I don't even know how to stop it. He says, but I do know this. I want to be with you, and I want to be like you. Do this, and let me be here, that I may proclaim the voice of thanksgiving, that I can let everybody know just how much I adore you. That would be the best way to describe that. And I just want to declare and let everybody know your wonders. Now, I like the word wonders because it literally means things that are too let's put it another way, things that are impossible for me to perform. So when we declare the wonders of God, what we're saying is, you know what he did? Something that I couldn't have done in a million years. That was a proclaiming the wonders of God. And isn't that a great, I mean, isn't that what we want to do? I want to go to God and I want to hear him say, I got it, done, taken care of. And I go, how did you do that? He goes, yeah, you would have never done it. And I said, I would have never been able to do that. David's beginning to realize that his love for God and his transparency in that love for God is the one thing that causes God to work on his behalf. Once again, the perception is if we just maintain busyness in our lives, if we just start rolling up our sleeves and doing what we think, but that's not faith. That's you doing it. Now, there's a time clearly for rolling up your sleeves and doing things. But this is not what our faith is based on. Our faith is based on, we know that you can do it. It was not the Israelites that saved themselves. It was God that saved the Israelites. And if in fact you're waiting for all the planets to align and everything to be perfect and, you know, you've got your backpack and all your supplies and everything, okay, now I'm going to serve God. God goes, you got to believe in the impossible. You got to believe that I'm going to do this way beyond what you could even ask or think. You're going to have to put your trust in me. God had literally placed David in such a situation that it was so overwhelming to him. He was throwing his hands up in the air, and he goes, you know what? I got to get that ark back to Jerusalem. Don't you think that's interesting? I mean, that's his solution. Really? You got these troublemakers? You're not going to get rid of them? I don't know what to do. I mean, if there were Philistines, no problem. We just go kill them. But he doesn't know what to do. He says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to hang around. We're going to get that ark back. I'm going to hang around it for a while. I'm just going to hang around God. I'm just going to tell God, God, can I just stay with you? Can we just be together? Can you take care of them? I hate the assembly of evildoers. I'm not going to sit there. And I'm going to wash my hands. And I'm going to proclaim just how wonderful you are. Verse 8. Oh, Lord, I like being here. I don't want to go anywhere else. This is the place. I don't want to be with them. I want to be with you. I want to be in your house. I want to be in a place where your glory, your copious splendor abides. I mean, wow, it's everywhere. It's being in the presence of God, how wonderful that is. Can you think of anything more wonderful than that? This is where I want to be. Don't take my soul along with sinners, or more specifically, don't allow me to go into the company of those people that are doing the wrong thing. Don't gather me together with them. Don't let me gather together. Don't let them gather me together. Nor with men with bloodshed. I don't want to be a part of that. I don't want that to be my life. I don't want it to be my legacy. In whose hands is a wicked scheme, and whose right hand is full of bribes. Scripture speaks of the bribe over and over and over again and uses this particular word. It never is used in a good sense that I could ever see. It has a sense of a gift for the purpose of injustice, being bought, a judge being bought off or something like that, whether that's a Exodus 23 or Proverbs 17, but it's somebody doing something for themselves, but caring less, they could care less for what was right and what was wrong. But as for me, verse 11, what does he say? I'm going to walk in integrity. Yeah, I'm not leaving this place. This is what I want. Now, what you have to do is you've got to rescue me from this. And you've got to be gracious. And it ends this way, verse 12. My foot stands on a level place. Upright, straight place. Which, by the way, if you go back to chapter, in the beginning of the chapter 26, verse 1, vindicate me, O Lord. I have walked in my integrity, and I have trusted in the Lord without, see that? Wavering, without sliding. What's going to keep you from sliding? If you're on a level place. God, keep me on a straight and level place, a place that's unconvoluted, a place that's pleasing and peaceful to you, not influenced by unjust scales, but it's a level place. My foot stands on a level place. His point is, and the focus is on the standing, which means that I'm holding my ground here. I'm not leaving this place. In the congregation, these are the people that want to bless God, right? In the congregations, I shall bless the Lord. The passage is one in which he's just fed up and doesn't know what to do with his surroundings. But he does know this, that somehow, if he attaches himself to God and demonstrates to God that he's the only one that he wants to serve, and if he comes with integrity of heart, that is to say, it is so crystal clear that that's the only thing he really wants, God will somehow take care of all these problems. He literally believes that. Mm-hmm. I have, for many years now, tried to live by this. As with you, I have had many things that, many sins that I have had to deal with in my own life, as I'm sure all of us do. But we come before the Lord and we get real with God. And I would trust that all of you, when you talk with God, it's not just throwing out some words in prayer, and it's not just to get him to do something for you. But when you pray to him, you're actually saying, you know what? You're the only one. You're the one that I really could care less what this person thinks of me. I really could care less what this happens. I just want to please you. And if I'm good with you, then I'm good. I'm fine with that. What the text is revealing is that the difficult times in our life cause us to long for right things. And if you're a true seeker, as John will make reference to, then the difficult times in your life will cause you to seek truth. You hang around people that lie habitually, and a true seeker comes to a point and he goes, I just don't think I can be here anymore. I just don't think I can take this anymore. I've got to get out of here. It's probably one of the reasons, and I would trust, it's one of the reasons why you might have found this church. Because maybe you came in contact with the disingenuous, the unreal, the people that weren't sincere about their faith, and you go, what? I just don't think I can take this anymore. Because the hypocrisy is just, the decisions that I've made about the church, and in some cases, literally, have caused the church not to grow, are decisions that I have made based on what I have seen and how sick I am of the lies that are perpetrated within churches. And I'm going, how many times have I said, I'd rather have 5 people that love the Lord than 5,000 that don't. Because as MacArthur says, most churches are like a giant birdbath. They're a mile wide and an inch deep. And it's true. We're not seeing the depth of desire. I see people all the time that have been in church all their life, and they probably couldn't tell you where Habakkuk is. Now, it's not the worst thing that can happen, but I'm going, why? What have you been reading? Where have you been going? What are you studying? What is your longing of your heart? God's talking to you in his word. They've probably read 50 other books, but they haven't read the Bible yet. And I'm going, I don't understand that. And when we come to God and we go, oh God, your word is more important to me than anything else. Your word is a lot. We sing the songs. And God goes, when are you going to stop lying to me? If you really love me, then do it. You know, you don't have to, oh, God, make me love you more. What do you mean by that? You know, what do you mean by that? Why wouldn't you love him? What good thing has he withheld from you? Not even his son. Why wouldn't you love him? So it's a motivating thing when you find yourself in circumstances and situations. And literally in my life, there have been certain things and decisions that I have made in regard to this church that were made because of the difficulties that I saw in church throughout the years. I saw wrong men being put in office, and I go, you know what? I'm never going to do that. I've seen people oppress other people just because they had an office in a church. I'm going, please, if you want control, run for president. But, you know, people will come to church and they'll try to control other people, and then they'll look condescending upon other people. And, well, you know, I have this position. Jesus turns to his disciples in John chapter 13. He goes, all right, so you want to follow me? Okay, let's start by washing people's feet. That doesn't even seem to compute anymore. But it's the sincerity and genuineness of the heart. And, you know, if any one of you want to study the Bible at any given time, you call me up, I'll meet with you. Have I ever not met with you? See, this, you have to walk in the sincerity of a heart. If you don't believe what you're saying, then what do you have? And the passage is telling us that it's that real, that transparency before God that protects you. I can tell you on a number of occasions, that's been the only thing that's protected me on a number of occasions. As the psalmist will later say, had it not been that the Lord was on my side, I'll say it again, he says, had it not been that the Lord is on my side, I would have had no hope. But you know, I don't have to worry about things seen or unseen. That there's a confidence, and this is his point, there is a confidence when I walk in the integrity of my heart. And that doesn't mean that I'm walking in such a way that you're necessarily pleased with me, but I can walk away saying, okay, God saw my heart, he knew what I wanted to do, and he knew that it was to elevate him. I can't tell you how many times right before I come to service, I go, God, I just don't want to mess this up for you. So help me not to mess this up. Because I don't want to say what Gary says, I want to say what you want me to say. And the last thing on my mind would be in any way to aggrandize man in any way. But God, I just want to point to you. So check me out. You see my heart. And you know, through the years, God has taken care of me. It's true, Psalm 37, he does give you the desires of your heart. Oftentimes, I have to admit, I didn't know what my desires really were because I thought that by doing one thing, I'd be happier. But, you know, God has just blessed me. I mean, how many times do I look at you during a week and say, we're so blessed, you know? What do you think guards that? The integrity of my heart. I'm trying to convey to you that the integrity of your heart means everything. Everything. And if this is not the standard by which you live by, you will not be safe. You will not have protection. God will not guard over you because God hates people that pretend obedience. God is looking for those that are washing their hands in purity and says, you see that? Clean. It is with this that I believe the reason why Psalm 26 is where it is because the psalmist has been taking us through the things that he's had to deal with. And sometimes it's been the disappointment of his own life. Oftentimes it is. But oftentimes it's been evil, injustice, unrighteousness. In many respects, I mean, you could turn back to Psalm chapter 4, and you could hear David goes, you know, I can't go to sleep. I'm thinking about all these really bad people that are doing these bad things, and they're lying, and they're cheating, and they're, and you're worked up. We've been talking about anger with the men, and you know, it's hard to fully comprehend Ephesians chapter 4 when it says be angry and sin not. So the be angry is in the imperative, which means it's a command. Now God is saying you need to be angry about this. The point is, of course, as James would say, but the anger of man, you can't do good with it. But God is doing something in your anger. And here's my point. Almost everything that I've decided to do in this ministry has caused me to do something good. I have met with groups of pastors, and I've sat in the circles of the pastors, and I've heard them laugh about things that they never should have laughed about, and I've heard them talk about things that they never should have talked about, and I've heard them brag about things that they never should have bragged about. And I said to myself, these meetings are worthless. They're empty. I will not go to them, nor will I send men to them. Now, that doesn't mean every man in those organizations or things, but I know what's there. I've been 20 years, I've been through that. So I know what's there. I know what's going on. The same thing is true with the way that we have elders and deacons, that we don't take vote with the congregation. Have you ever been in a congregational meeting where they're deciding over the superficial, superfluous things? Have you ever been in one? Oh, man, it's a wonder to behold. I never thought I would hear people cursing in church, but they do. And I never dreamed that I would see people throw things, and they will. Over trivial matters. Do you know why Scripture says, let the spiritual rule? Because if you're not thinking spiritually, you're not going to do the right thing. You make decisions during these times. Now, let me tell you something. I have seen abuse in these offices where there's obviously gross abuse. And instantly, my blood began to boil. Good thing. Amen. Good thing. But the purpose of that anger is to ignite and to jumpstart you to do good. And this is why you don't let your anger continue. We were talking about it Saturday with the men, and the way I describe it with men, I don't know if women can relate to it, but anger is like the starter in your engine, in your car. So it's there to crank something up. But you hold the starter, you're going to destroy the engine. You're going to mess everything. You don't just keep holding it. Of course, right now, probably more a button. I don't know what happens if you hold the button. I haven't gone that far. But the point is, you let go of it once the engine gets started. Now, what God does, and it really is His grace, is He oftentimes puts us in situations that just infuriate us. Infuriated. I got to do something about it. And God goes, good. I thought you would never get off your apathetic rear end and do something. Because the fact of the matter is you won't do anything, I won't do anything till it hits us passionately. That's the truth. There's a lot of things that you're going to care less about until it affects you directly. But when it does, you started moving. Hey, he got off the couch. God goes, good, good. Now, what are you going to do with that anger? Do good. You know, the discipleship that we've written comes as a result of men not being discipled. I mean, I can think of almost every good thing that has come into this church that we have began to use as a practice, even the way that we make our decisions. We try to make our decisions based on how can we help somebody out. And oftentimes, financially, it's not the best decision, but it's always the best decision in building up the body. I've been in plays where people were so intense on, you know, making the Hollywood production that they just walked over everybody and seemed to hate everybody around them, and it was a church play. But the purpose of it is what? I mean, aren't we supposed to be building up the body? Aren't we supposed to be encouraging and helping people? And sometimes you're going to put maybe people that aren't the greatest of actors in these positions, but you're thinking differently. I'm telling you that the things that caused me to be angry are the very things that caused me to do something. And most of all, what this passage is telling us is, it'll cause you to run to God, and it'll cause you to run to God's people. Because when you're out in that world and you have to face all of the hardship and all the pain and all the lies and all of the subterfuge and all of the things that are going on, you're going, can I just find some people that are like real? Can I find some people that care about things that need to be cared about? And you know, you probably wouldn't have looked for them had all those things not happened. He probably wouldn't have looked to get the ark into Jerusalem. But you know, he goes through all that and he goes, you know, I don't want to go anyplace else. I'm going to sit right here. I'm going to be with you. And hey, brother, you want to sing a song with me? We start singing together. And you go, this is the greatest place. Can I just stay here? Can I just stay here? And it's what unites the body and what brings us together. God's going to be using things in your life, and it'll cause you to long for the straight and level. It'll cause you to love God and his people more. It'll cause you to want to do the right thing. It'll cause you and a jump start you to do all kinds of things that you probably would have never done. I hear people from time to time, and it's interesting because Proverbs talks about the wicked man has no concerns for the poor people. But the righteous, you know, sees the poor and, you know, obviously gets involved. I know that there are some people, it just seems like their heart is stirred. You know, my heart is really stirred for this. And sometimes they wonder, well, what about these people? What about these people? And the thought is, you know, you almost get upset because nobody seems to be doing anything to help them. And I can just hear the voice of God going, yeah, I hear you. So what are you going to do? You see, if God is stirring your heart, what about these people that are lost somewhere? And, you know, they've never heard the gospel. Okay, so what are you, I can just hear God going, so what are you going to do? I already feel this for them. I already love them. I already want to see them saved. I want to see you get up off your seat and go help them so that you can be like me. And if getting you angry will do that, it's good. It's good to be angry. Be angry. Just don't sin. Don't fight evil with evil. Fight evil with good. And you'll begin to build a wonderful thing. But I can tell you every time it'll get you to church. It will. It'll get you with. And you'll be looking for somebody in the church that's sincere. And you'll go, brother, can I talk to you? And you'll know when you find them, because when you sit down and talk to them, they love God's word as much as you do. And there's nothing else that they want to talk about, and they're just consumed with it, and they'll talk all night with you if you want to. Father, I give you thanks for this passage that encourages us to leave the way of the world and the verbiage of the world, the hostility of it. Confusing times. It's a confusing world. It's a hostile place. I don't want to be here. But it's good that I was in it. so that I might run away from it, but more that I might run to you. And more than that, it just makes me really sincere and genuine for you. I think before I was probably just lackadaisical about even talking to you. But these difficult times really gets me on my knees, and the things that really anger me and upset me cause me to just seek your face. And I realize the thing I want to do, the one I want to be like, is you. The world's solution is to destroy and take advantage, but not you. Your solution is the altar. God, make me like you. Make me like you. Make me like you. As I circle this altar, turn me into your image and cause me to sacrifice myself to eradicate evil. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.